Well, it's time for us to begin. If you would please, let's open our Bibles to Luke's account. I want to begin in verse 1 and read about 12 verses that I want to use primarily for our text this evening. Luke's account, chapter 23, beginning in verse 1. And the whole company of them rose up and brought him before Pilate. They began to accuse him, saying, "We found this man perverting our nation, forbidding to give tribute to Caesar, and saying that he himself is Christ, a king." And Pilate asked him, saying, "Art thou the king of the Jews?" And he answered him and said, "Thou sayest." And Pilate said unto the chief priests and the multitudes, "I find no fault in this man." But they were the more urgent, saying, "He stirreth up the people, teaching throughout all Judea, and beginning from Galilee even unto this place." But when Pilate heard it, he asked whether the man were a Galilean. And when he knew that he was of Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him unto Herod, who himself also was at Jerusalem in these days. And when Herod saw Jesus, he was exceeding glad, for he was of a long time desirous to see him, because he had heard concerning him, and he hoped to see some miracle done by him. And he questioned him in many words, but he answered him nothing. And the chief priests and the scribes stood vehemently accusing him. And Herod with his soldiers set him at naught and mocked him, and arraying him in gorgeous apparel, sent him back to Pilate. And Herod and Pilate became friends with each other that very day, for before they were at enmity between themselves. We'll see why in just a little bit. But in our study tonight, we've talked about how that Pilate has interrogated Jesus, and we've talked about how that the Jews cry out the charges, as you see in verse 2 and then again in verse 5. But our point this evening is to note that Pilate sent Jesus, when he found out that Jesus was from Galilee, to Herod, who was in the city of Jerusalem, to pretty much appease the desires of the Jews. Keep in mind that Pilate and Herod and a lot of other fellows had been appointed as governors over certain portions of the land to keep peace among the Jews. And to keep peace among the Jews, it seems that their desire was just to do what's necessary to keep them happy. We saw that to be the case with Pilate, and we see that to be the case even with Herod. Now, we've talked about the character of Pilate, and we've noted that he's not a very nice fellow. Neither was Herod. I ask you to do a little bit of study about Herod, and Richard was very kind to send me somewhat of a family tree that's very close to the one that we have in our lesson book on history and geography of the Bible. Richard may not like this, but I've altered it a little bit because there are some things that I wanted to go in it that weren't on the original one. We know that Herod the Great is described by most as a wise administrator. It was Herod the Great who had rebuilt the temple, added on to the temple in the city of Jerusalem. He had granted Jews privileges, and of course that made him popular among the Jews, and that's what he was after. However, in Matthew the first chapter, on into the second chapter, and then in Luke the first chapter, we read about Herod the Great, how that when the wise men came to find Jesus, they were asked where baby Jesus, or where the King of the Jews, was going to be born. And of course, they were familiar with the prophets. But the prophecy of Malachi identified that he was to be born in Bethlehem. And you know the events, or how they came to pass. Jesus was taken by his earthly father and mother then on down into Egypt for a time, until that Herod died. And then he was brought back and raised in the city of Nazareth, but he was born in Bethlehem, and the prophets revealed that baby or the King of the Jews would be born in the city of Bethlehem. And Herod the Great, then, when he sought for him and didn't find him, he had all the little baby boys that were 2 years old and younger, had them all killed. Now, that's who Herod the Great is. And the Herod that we're studying about in this text is Herod Antipas. What I want us to see in this is he comes from a line of folks that are not very nice. And he himself was not very nice. What we know about Herod the Great was he was scared of his own shadow, and anybody that presented any kind of a threat to him or perceived threat to him, he had them executed, and that includes two of his own grandsons. Now, what does that tell you about Herod the Great?
Really bad.
He's determined to maintain his power. Anything that presented itself as a threat to him, whether it was Jesus or whether it was his own grandsons, he wants them dead. And so, enough on Herod the Great. We could go on, but that's sufficient, I think, to get before us the kind of character that the Herodian family tree has. When we talk about Herod Antipas, I don't know if you can see on the screen well enough to know much about him or not, but if you turn to Mark's account, Matthew's account, chapter 14, we know that it's this Herod that despised John the Baptist, because John the Baptist kept telling him, it's not lawful for you to have your brother Philip's wife. That's the Herod that we're talking about. And so it's Herod Antipas then that had married Herodias. How'd you like that? I worked to get that for that day. He had married Herodias, and this is what caused John to be beheaded, because he had criticized the marriage relationship between the two of them. Now we've got another Herod over here, Herod Philip, that married Salome, who was the daughter of this relationship. And so you see the family tree gets intertwined right quick. And so we've got all kinds of difficulties with that. Now, one of the things that I did want to note in the listing of the Herod family tree is Herod Antipas. Down here we talk about Herod Agrippa the First in this family tree. It was this Herod that had Peter and James in prison in Acts chapter 12 and beheaded James. And when he saw how happy that made the Jews, then he was going to behead, it appears from the text, Peter, but Peter miraculously escaped, and you read that in the first several verses of Acts chapter 12. And then another Herod, of course, that becomes very prominent in our study is Herod Agrippa II, and he's the fellow that Paul made his defense before in Acts chapter 25 and 26. So this just kind of gives us an idea. Here you've got Herod Agrippa, Bernice and Drusilla. This whole family was just filled with corruption from the get-go, from the start to the finish of it. Any questions about this? Now, I don't intend to get all bogged down in the family tree, because there's a lot of stuff you could ask me, and I just have to say I don't know. Randy, go ahead.
I was just going to say, there's some stuff on there that's kind of hard to follow.
It is kind of hard to follow.
There's the name Herod Phillips, I can see three different places.
Yeah, I get that.
One or two?
Well, we've got both. Here's Herod Agrippa the First, and here's Herod Agrippa the Second.
Which one had James beheaded?
First.
The first one.
Now, in answer to your question, Randy, about Herod Philip, I get it. It gets a little complicated when you look here and you look here.
And then down below,
yeah,
on the right.
Yeah, it wasn't, yeah. Well, you see, Herod Antipas and Herod, this family tree gets a little complicated. I'm not sure it's the one that's in our book. It's similar, but it gets a little complicated. I think I almost just eliminated this part of it, but I couldn't do that really without eliminating these, and I wanted to keep them on it. Because you see who that is. We've got Herodias and Philip that have a daughter, and evidently Herodias Philip, or I'm not sure. I get bogged down in this side of this chart.
You know, it's not unlike European royalty, where it's crisscross and repeated.
Yeah, it is. And in all honesty, when I started going through this particular family tree, I saw the same thing, Randy, and I thought, I'm not going to be weighed down and spend hours trying to wade through all that, because the Herods that I want to talk about, they're on here. And the thing that we have to be aware of is this is the one that we're talking about in our text that Jesus was interviewed in front of you.
So in a nutshell, Herod the Great is the one that was in charge when Jesus was born.
That's correct.
Herod Antipas is the one that Jesus saw after Pilate.
As far as I know, that's correct.
Herod Agrippa I is the one that had James killed.
Yes.
And Herod Agrippa II is the one that Paul spoke.
That's correct.
Okay. And if we can get that from this chart, then I'm satisfied. I don't really want to explore all these other names. And I got a little bogged down when I saw Bernice over here and saw Bernice over here. And yeah. Salome down here and Salome up here and Salome over here. I got a little confused with some of that too. I'm not going to try to unwind all of that. But it would entail a good bit of time that I just didn't have to commit to this chart.
But all of these, they're all called King Herod.
Yes, they are.
And they're all appointed by Rome.
Yes. Yes.
Over and Palestine. So.
Yes, and of course what you've got here, yes, over Palestine. Well, over Judea, because we've got Pilate is governor down here, and I didn't say that right. We've got Pilate who's governor down in Judea, and we've got Herod who's governor up in Galilee. He's in Judea, specifically in Jerusalem, to observe these feast days.
I just noticed at the top under Herod the Great it says king over Palestine. That was his realm.
Well, now, he might have been king over Palestine, but by the time we get to here, he's Herod over Galilee, and that's what we see in the text, over the province of Galilee. I think the point that I want us to see from this is the background of the family tree. We've just got a whole bunch of folks that are wicked, wicked people. And we look at our politics today, and we stand in awe, and we say, oh, it never has been like, oh, yeah, it's been this way all through history. This is just politics, and that's what existed during the New Testament times. And I think sometimes we perhaps get overly concerned about the politics of our day as if there wasn't any politics in New Testament times. Why was James killed? The whole point of that was politics. And so why were Christians persecuted? The whole point of that was politics, for the most part.
And then, if memory serves, they were Edomites, right?
Yes, the Herods were Edomites, yes. And that's important, especially when we look at the rebuke of John to Herod Antipas. It's not lawful for you to have your brother Philip's wife. Some say, well, it was not lawful because Herod was a Jew under the law of Moses. That's not the case. Herod was not a Jew. He was an Idumean and an Edomite. And consequently, the law, we don't have to stop at the law of Moses. It's not lawful from the beginning for you to have your brother Philip's wife. Now, the reason that some make that argument, I'm going off on a tangent here because this is something that has been argued so intensely in times gone by. But the reason some make that argument is it's not lawful for you to have your brother Philip's wife. They say, well, that was incest. Well, for it to be a case of intimacy, as it were, with siblings, yes, it would be. And even as we go back to the Old Testament text, to take your brother's wife. You know, we don't have a direct bloodline, but you were not to take your brother's wife. That was condemned. Not because it was necessarily adultery. It was simply unlawful for you to take your brother's wife. Well, she's already got a husband, you see. So, yes, that was included in the sin of incest during Old Testament times. I don't hesitate to say that because we can read the verse. I've had occasion to have to go back and do that. But our point here is that Herod Antipas and all of these guys, they were just wicked people. They transgressed God's law right and left, had no regard for it. And the point of being not a Jew is beside the point. Yes, they were not under the law of Moses. They wanted to accommodate the Jews, so they surrendered, they would have you believe, to the law of Moses and observe the feast days. But the purpose was political. I don't know how to stress that hardly enough. But this is what you've got. Now, let's go back just a little bit and look at some of these other charts and see if we can glean a little more from who these characters were, in particular this Herod Antipas, the tetrarch or the governor of Galilee. one of the sons, as we noted on the previous chart, of Herod the Great. And we've noted that when the wise men came from the east to worship the Christ, they stopped at the palace of Herod the Great in Jerusalem, and the scribe said he's to be born in Jerusalem. No, that's not right. He's to be born in Bethlehem. I've said that wrong a time or two, haven't I? He was to be born in Bethlehem. If you talk to a Mormon now and you make that slip of tongue, they'll agree, because the Book of Mormon has Jesus being born in Jerusalem. Just so you know, that's inaccurate. But they were warned to go home because Herod planned to harm the child. Herod the Great was so furious that he ordered all the babies 2 years old to die. Matthew 2 and verse 16. Now, this Herod the Great, I don't know how to describe this man, Herod the Great, any more than saying he was obsessed with being king. And as we mentioned, even if his grandchildren, he's not going to be threatened. Anybody that threatened his throne, he had them killed. Wikipedia. Any of you go to Wikipedia for information? Well, it's a pretty popular place, I understand. I've learned to be suspect of it at times. But Wikipedia said that he had been described as a madman who murdered his own family and a great many rabbis. The evil genius of the Judean nation prepared to commit any crime in order to gratify his unbounded ambition. I'd say that's pretty close to accurate from what I've read in other sources. So he thought you were a threat to his throne. He killed you. He was cruel. Killed his father-in-law, by the way, two brothers-in-laws, and at least two sons and a favorite wife, and we've noted two grandchildren, as I showed on the other chart, if I have that correct. He killed the last man in the Hasmonean dynasty. You're familiar with that during the Maccabean revolt. He professed to observe the law of Moses, yet his life was just a mockery of the same. He imprisoned chief men of the Jews and ordered that they be killed upon his death to ensure mourners at his death. Now, my understanding is that wasn't carried out, but can you imagine essentially having to pay people to walk in the funeral procession because you're so despised by the public? That's this man that we're talking about, Herod the Great. He ordered the death of 45 members of the Jewish court that had opposed him at one point in his life. And now here is his son, Herod Antipas, who had imprisoned and executed John in the city to please the Jews. Now, interestingly enough, Luke is the only account that we have of this. You can read of the trials of Jesus in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, but Luke includes this tidbit. I might make this suggestion. You probably already know this, but if you're studying one of the Gospels, just one, I would suggest the Gospel of Luke. It backs up the farthest in history and comes forward the farthest and gives more details than the other accounts give. Now, that doesn't mean it gives all of the accounts or all of the details in the account. We've already talked about some that John presents that Luke and the other Gospels do not include. But what we learn in this instance about Luke's account is that Herod is just what I've called a curiosity seeker. He's curious about what he's heard about Jesus. He's heard that he's been performing miracles, and he'd really hoped to see one. So he's what we call fellows like that, thrill seekers. He's just looking for the rush of seeing Jesus perform a miracle. But he mocked Jesus and arrayed him in this gorgeous apparel. Herod then sent him back to Pilate. And this text tells us that they became friends that day. Our text in Luke, the 23rd chapter, tells us, the 24th chapter, no, the 23rd chapter, right, place on the wrong page. In verse 12, Herod and Pilate became friends with each other that very day, for before they were at enmity between themselves. Now, the thing that kind of makes me smile a little bit about that is, yes, they were at enmity among themselves. This historian in the book called Light from the Ancient Past, I think I've got a copy of that in my library, records that King Herod Agrippa I had charged Pilate. This is King Herod I. I've got this wrong on this chart. I thought this was Herod Antipas. Never mind that. But his son, King Herod Agrippa I had charged Pilate with corruptibility, violence, robberies, ill treatment of people, grievances, continuous execution without even the form of a trial, endless and intolerable cruelties. So that would be Herod Antipas' son, Herod Agrippa I, that had charged him with that. But it makes you wonder where he got such a notion. Explain what I just said. All right. Well, if you took this right here, King Herod Agrippa I,
yes, I'm there.
That's wrong.
Okay.
King Herod Agrippa I allegedly said these things about Pilate. But I mistakenly had this quotation regarding King Herod Agrippa I under the heading of Herod Antipas. It was not Herod Antipas that said this. It was King Herod Agrippa I, Antipas' son. Okay.
So that's true.
It is true, yeah.
That's
but I've got the wrong Herod.
All this quote. I'm confused because you just said that it's not that and then you said that it is that.
Okay, let me try it again. See, this chart is on Herod Antipas.
Yes.
Okay. And I've got a quote here identifying something that King Herod Agrippa I said. King Herod Agrippa I is not Herod Antipas.
Right. Okay. That didn't confuse me at all.
Okay.
It's on the wrong chart.
Yeah, it's on the wrong chart. Yeah, it's a true statement. Yeah, the statement is true, but it's about the wrong Herod. Okay? It was his son that said this.
So the note itself is correct.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the note is correct. It's on the wrong chart. We're talking about Herod Antipas, and the note is about Herod Agrippa the First. Okay?
And the Herods were appointed by
Rome.
Rome?
Mm-hmm. Appointed by Rome.
And they were Hellenistic Jews.
I'm sorry?
You said something about not being Hellenistic Jews. They're Edomites.
No, I said they were not Jews. They were Edomites. They were not Jewish at all.
That's interesting because, like you said, Wikipedia says that they were Hellenistic Jews.
Interesting. Well, the Herods were not Jewish at all. They were Greeks. They were Edomites, to be specific. Idumeans, Edomites. Yeah, like I said, Wikipedia is a source for information, but I don't believe they're always on top of it.
Well, you know,
they do. They do. They probably got Herod Agrippa I on the wrong chart. Okay. All right. Well, I want to spend a little time on this judgment that Pilate is authorized by Rome. To make. I think that deserves a little bit of comment and thinking. In verse 4, you'll note concerning Pilate, Luke's account, chapter 23, verse 4, Pilate said unto the chief priest and the multitudes, I find no fault in this man. Now that's after he's heard their accusations. I don't find any evidence of a fault in this man. In verses 14 and 15, after Herod delivers Jesus back to Pilate, it says that Pilate called together the chief priests and the elders, or rulers, rather, of the people, and said unto them, Ye brought unto me this man as one that perverteth the people. And behold, I have examined him before you and found no fault in this man touching those things whereof ye accuse him. No, nor yet Herod. For he sent him back unto us, and behold, nothing worthy of death hath been found, or been done, rather, by him. Now that's really helpful for us to see that this is the Roman side of the trial, before Pilate and before Herod. And now back before Pilate, and Pilate says, I've found no crime in him, I find nothing worthy of death, the charges that you have lodged have no evidence, no foundation at all, there's no reason for me to charge this man. Now, take note of that. What's Pilate trying to do?
Release
him. He's trying to release him, yes. But...
Yeah.
Well, he don't want to rock the boat, yes, that's right. I would suggest to you he's trying to walk the tight wire or the razor's edge because he sees that he has a judgment to make. And he really don't want to make this judgment. He really don't want to. Because there's not any evidence to condemn this man to death. But yet the Jews are demanding the death penalty. Jesus has already been railroaded through the Jewish court and they have condemned him to die. And so now what do we do? What would you do if you were Pilate? Oh, he's got a hard choice here to make.
And you know, it's, now Pilate is not a Herod. Okay.
No.
But he's evil in his own.
Oh, yes.
It's surprising that he doesn't just go, oh, well, just, you know, off his head. I mean.
He does.
Because he does eventually. But I mean that he even says, no, I can't find anything wrong with him.
Yeah. But I think in such an evil person, as we know Pilate is, there are at least three attempts to release Jesus because there's no charge that will stick worthy of death. And so here we go. Pilate's judgment, all right? I don't find any fault in him. So I will propose that you have a custom. And during this time, the custom is to release a prisoner. How about I release Barabbas? Okay. Pardon me?
He was popular.
Oh, he was. He was a notable robber, an insurrectionist, even a murderer. And that's who this man is. Now, here you've got a man that's been before Herod, been before Pilate, and neither one of them. Corrupt politicians to the core. But they're not willing to pronounce the death sentence, either one of them, because there's no evidence to do that. Now here's a man, Barabbas, a notable prisoner, murderer. What do you think Pilate is thinking at this point? What will the Jews surely want?
Yeah, they're not going to want the Charlie Manson type of guy. They'll pick the guy who seems innocent.
Yeah. And so, what did they do? They didn't go that route. They said, release Barabbas. We'll take him over Jesus. Now, does that give you any kind of indication of the hatred? How the deck is stacked. And then Pilate's wife came to him. As he was sitting on the judgment seat, his wife sent unto him saying, have thou nothing to do with that righteous man, for I have suffered many things this day in a dream because of him. His wife came to him. He's not guilty of anything. You don't have anything to do with that. Now, Pilate would have done well if he'd listened to his wife. But being the honorable man that he is, of course, you wouldn't expect that, would you? So he's declared, I don't find him guilty of any crime. How about I at least release Barabbas? Pilate's wife said, don't have anything to do with him. And then the third effort, Pilate said, I'll chastise him and release him. Now, chastisement was not just saying, don't do that anymore. Chastisement was the flogging. And we talked about this Sunday night. I won't belabor the point. All of you were here Sunday night and you saw this chart. One that I think is, though it's just a black and white kind of pencil drawing, it's very graphic, to illustrate what a flogging was, what it would do to you. Now, Pilate's reasoning on this was, if he survives the flogging, many did not, then I'll release him. And when he was flogged, then what did the Jews cry out?
Crucifying.
That's not enough. We're not satisfied. Now, in this flogging or scourging, the Jews used rods. We've studied about that. Paul, in his defense of his tribulations or trials, in 2 Corinthians chapter 11, beginning actually verse 23, he says, I was beaten with rods three times. Okay? And the limit was 40. So 40, save one. 39, just in case somebody miscounted, it was against the law to give over 40 stripes. Okay? But we find that the Romans used this kind of an instrument like we had on the other chart. And can you imagine what this would do? Right across your back, sometimes by two different men, one on one side, one on the other. Just ripping you to shreds. You see why, then, many did not survive the scourging or the flogging. And this is what Pilate did. If he lives, I'll release him. No, they didn't want that. Now, here's where he said, off with his head. When he saw that wouldn't satisfy, and that he prevailed nothing, but rather a tumult was arising, he took water and washed his hands before the multitude, saying, I am innocent of the blood of this righteous man. see ye to it. Now, brethren, those last words that I've tried to emphasize on the board, I don't know how that you can put them in the same sentence with, I am innocent of the blood of this righteous man. How can you say, I am innocent of the blood, and then declare of this righteous man, while at the same time giving the order to execute him? He's a politician. Yeah, okay. So it don't cost him anything. See ye to it. I want us to see just how important our words can be. But here is a man that had the role of potentially releasing Jesus. Now, when Jesus was being interrogated by this man, Pilate rebuked him, all right. Don't you know that I have the authority to release you? And what did Jesus say to him?
You wouldn't have any authority if my Father hadn't given it.
No, you wouldn't have any unless my Father gave it to you. And regarding deliverance from this man, when these things began to develop, what did Jesus say that he commanded in terms of angels? 12 legions of angels. And if your dad was here, we'd ask him about what one angel can do. And we know that one angel can slay at least 185,000 soldiers, just one. What do you think 12 legions could do? Well, you see the point. But when Pilate gave the order, and I don't know how to put it any other way, that's what he did. He gave the order. When he said, see ye to it, he just gave them the thumbs up to take him out and crucify him. And that's what they did. So Pilate tried every method that I'm aware of, but one, to release Jesus. He had declared him innocent numerous times. He sent him to Herod to try to get some more input from Herod. Herod didn't help him. He offered to release a prisoner. He had Jesus scourged, and then he washed his hands, but notice in Mark's account, wishing to content the multitude. He said, see ye to it. Now that's consistent with what Isaiah said, and we'll talk about this. In Isaiah 53 and verse 7, he was oppressed, yet when he was afflicted, he opened not his mouth. As a lamb that is led to the slaughter, and as a sheep that before its shearers is dumb, so he opened not his mouth. Now one of the things that we've noted is that during these public trials, if you want to call them that, Jesus was essentially silent. He didn't put forth some defense. He didn't argue his case. He was silent. Now why? It was prophesied that it was going to happen.
He knew.
He'd already told his disciples on the way into Jerusalem, well, just prior to the entrance into Jerusalem, that he would be arrested. He would be tried. He would be crucified. And on the third day, he would be raised from the dead. But let's go again. Why didn't he put forth an argument? It was prophesied. He knew. We got something else. There's no other way that sin could be forgiven. You remember in the garden, he asked the Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Now, what do we learn?
It wasn't possible.
It wasn't possible that redemption, atonement, could be obtained any other way. Now, when we read in the Hebrew account, in Hebrews chapter 5, we have a quotation there from an Old Testament prophet. And it escapes me now who the Old Testament prophet was. Let me look just very quickly. Hebrews chapter 5. No, it's not chapter 5. It's chapter 10, verse 5. And the Old Testament prophet was David from the Psalms. Hebrews chapter 10, verse 5. Sacrifice and offering thou wouldest not, but a body didst thou prepare for me. In whole burnt offerings and sacrifices for sin thou hadst no pleasure. Then said I, lo, I am come. And the roll of the book is written of me, to do thy will, O God. Now there wasn't any argument. Because of the submissive will of Jesus to submit to the will of the Father, there wasn't any way that atonement for you and I could be had any other way. You think Jesus understood the gravity of this when he stood before these men in these trials? There's no argument. This is going to be. It's going to be. You remember in John chapter 10 when Jesus said that no man taketh my life, but I lay it down, and I have power to take it up again? when we think of the crucifixion of Jesus and all of this setting, let's get fixed in our mind that Pilate, yes, we can criticize Pilate because he gave the thumbs up to the soldiers to kill him. But as far as the politics and the authority of man is concerned, this was to go through the judicial process, including Pilate. But the plan had been determined long before. Not that men acted without their will. Pilate's will was certainly in this, as well as the will of the Jews. But don't discount the will of our Lord. He willed this too. Had to be. In order to accomplish redemption. Now, Pilate's motivation was altogether different. The Jews' motivation was altogether different, and the Roman soldiers didn't care. Their job was to execute. I was talking to somebody this week of some that tried to defend that the resurrection of Jesus really didn't happen because Jesus wasn't really dead. You've studied this in times gone by, called the swoon theory, that he had just passed out. He wasn't really dead. Well, when you read of those executioners, that's what they were. Did they have the skill and the know-how to know when they had accomplished their task of executing somebody? Well, you know, even I've never been a witness to somebody that's been executed, but my understanding is that when somebody is executed as a result of our judicial process, there's somebody on hand that is an authority that can determine whether or not the man's dead. You think they didn't know when a man was dead? Is this some new invention we've come up with? No. But let's see that, yes, it was a matter of prophecy, but it was a matter of will. The will of Pilate, the will of the multitudes, both Roman and Jewish, and the will of the Lord to submit his will that this would be accomplished for our redemption. All right, any questions or comments here? Yes, Randy?
Just a comment, I guess, and just seeing the irony with the Jews, you know, going back in time, when they rejected Samuel and demanded that they have a king. And Samuel said, you know, they've rejected me. And God said, they haven't rejected you. They've rejected me from being king. So they demanded a king, and so God gave them a king. And in this instance, they reject the king and say, we have no king but Caesar. And it's just ironic.
Well, there's a lot of irony in all of this. I find one of the most fascinating pieces of irony in this whole story of the last week of Jesus is when he came into the city, how they praised him. And they declared him to be their king. And now, what are they saying? We have no king but Caesar. This man, Christ, he calls himself a king. And he's telling us not to give tribute to Caesar. But we have no king but Caesar. And he's corrupted our nation. Look at what all mess he's made out of things. Well, just a couple of days before, they were willing to put him on the throne. Well, what's happened now?
Well, it was also the difference between the leadership and the common people. The common people, they were the ones that were calling him king. Hosanna. The leadership never did.
No, the leadership did not. But again, the irony of all of this that's just perplexing in some instances is when they cried out, crucify him, crucify him. Who was doing that? It wasn't just the religious leaders. Yeah, they did. In 2 days. They take people from one swing of the pendulum over here praising him and declaring him as king and essentially worshiping him as king to crying out, he's not our king. Kill him. Now, you talk about the Jewish leaders. Yes, they influenced the people. We've got that. But how quickly a multitude can be influenced, and how far a multitude can be influenced.
Mob rule.
Mob rule. Yeah, there's some powerful lessons in this we don't want to miss. Yeah, I think there's some things to learn. Let's talk about the crucifixion. Think we can do that in 8 minutes? Well,
you did it on Sunday.
I did. Yeah, I did. Well, we've got to build up to it, you know. The last week of Jesus' life, I didn't know exactly where these sharks would land. Last week of Jesus' life, on Friday before, we're a week into this now. The Friday before, he's on his way, 6 days before the Passover. Saturday's the Sabbath. He's at the house of Simon the leper. Mary is anointing his feet with the expensive ointment, and Judas is saying, don't pour it out. Let's sell it. And then Sunday, the next day, Jesus entered into the city, riding on a young colt, went into the temple. cast out the money changers and so forth. On Monday, the next day, cursed the fig tree, cleansed the temple. I got that on the wrong day. Cleansed the temple down here on Monday, and every evening he went out of the city to Bethany, where he spent the night, and then returned into the city. On Tuesday, a long day in the morning, the fig tree was dried up. As a result of Jesus cursing it, he came into the temple, was questioned about his authority. He told these three parables that we have in the text of chapter 21 on into 22. Jesus then discussed four questions that he was asked, and the design of the questions was to try to entrap him. We note that every day he taught in the temple. On Tuesday, as it continues, he warned the multitude about the scribes and the Pharisees, calling them hypocrites. Things are building to a crescendo, aren't they? And before he went out of the temple, he taught on the Mount of Olives. We saw that, Matthew 24 and following, declaring that after 2 days is the Passover, when the events leading to his death began, Matthew 26. Every day he was teaching in the temple, he went out at night and lodged Mount Olivet, Mount of Olives. On that Wednesday, we were grappling to try to determine a lot of events that occurred on Wednesday. I don't know of a specific event that occurred on Wednesday, except to note that every day he came to the temple, and the people came early to hear him. I would assume that took place on Wednesday as well, and Wednesday was full with those kind of events. Thursday was the preparation of for the celebration of the Passover, the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. That night, Jesus ate the Passover. Thursday night, early into Friday morning, of course, we saw at the conclusion of the Passover, he instituted the Lord's Supper. Thursday night, early into Friday morning, Jesus was arrested and brought before Caiaphas and Annas, the high priest, and we talked about that. Caiaphas was the one that had the official authority. We noted then on Friday morning early, he was brought before Pilate, presented then to Herod, and was crucified on the preparation day, which is called the day before the Sabbath, in Mark's account.
Go back to Pilate after
Herod. Yes. Right here?
In Luke 23, yes.
Yeah, he went back to Pilate after he was there.
Yeah, yeah.
Pilate made the final.
Yeah, opinion. Yeah. You could insert, right?
Pilate, and then back to Pilate.
Yeah, you could insert that right here. Went back to Pilate in between here.
Yeah, because he said, you know, wash my hands of it.
Yeah. Yeah, you could put that in between there. Okay? So this trial, sometime... I'm sorry?
And that's when he chastised him and hoped he'd
bucket. Yeah. Yeah. Well, okay. Hoped he would survive it so he could release him.
So he was crucified on Friday.
I believe that's right.
Before sundown.
I believe that's right. Because sundown would mark the beginning of the Sabbath.
He wasn't released in between.
He was not released, no. 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 Pilate did not release him.
Was this. This is always. That is one of the confusion for me. Passover was a week. It took a week to observe it. But it was supposed to be on the 14th day of the first month. Was that the end of that week or the beginning of that week?
End of that week.
The end of that week.
As I recall, yeah.
So he was crucified on the Passover day.
It would have been, yeah. It would have been if...
isn't there... There's one place where it says it was a high Sabbath.
Yeah. That's why.
Because it landed the day after.
They had the Passover meal on Thursday night.
Yeah, yeah. Keep in mind.
Friday.
Yeah, keep in mind, though, their way of counting time is different from ours. Yeah, sunset to sunset. So that explains that. And it also helps us when we begin to talk about the 3 days as well.
And it adds the profundity of John calling him the Lamb of God.
Yeah.
He's the Lamb of God, and he was crucified on Passover.
And the Apostle Paul identifying Christ as our Passover. And where is that? 2 Corinthians 5:7, I think.
And how many times is he referred to as the Lamb in Revelation?
And the Apostle Peter said, "You were redeemed, not with corruptible things, silver, gold, but with precious blood as of a lamb." Yeah, the analogies are are continual through this period. Okay? Any questions or comments just here? Crucifixion. Let's talk about what it is. Sometimes a fellow, or the victim, as we have on the board, was tied to the cross and then just left to die of starvation. Tied to the cross. Sometimes the condemned or the victim was laid against the wooden crossbeam and nails were driven through the hands into the wood. A foot was pressed backward against the other. On the diagram we saw Sunday night, we saw that. And a large nail was driven through the arch of the feet into the post. Now, before we go to the next chart, I want to make this observation. There has been a lot of input over the years about the shape of the cross, and most of the time that we see it, it's something kind of like this, up on a high hill, way up high. I believe that's just error, just plain error. I don't believe that was the case at all. The Romans, who had pretty much perfected this means of execution, it was cheap. They're not going to take the time or the work or the effort to put you up on something that's going to be a lot of trouble to them. Sometimes they'd just nail you to a tree. Sometimes it was nothing more than a post. They'd just nail you to the post.
This was a place that was used for that.
Used for execution, yeah. So whether this cross was brand new or not, you know, we don't have any ideas about that. We do know that Jesus carried his cross. And whether we're talking about carrying a whole cross piece or just the cross beam, I don't know that we could prove that one way or the other. The text tells us that he carried his cross. Sometimes a cross was just two boards nailed together like an X, and you were nailed to it. The idea is to make it as cruel and painful as you could possibly do. And the very idea of leaving somebody just tied to it and hoping they'd starve to death before they died was something. We have time.
I'll tell you
right now. Okay. All right. Well, we'll start with this next time, review a little of this.